Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
You know, Ken, one of the most important political stories of this past week concerns your home city, New York City.
That's correct. New York 9 on Tuesday.
Congressional District Number 9.
For the first time Lester Volk in 1920.
Lester Volk was a Republican?
He was, and he was defeated by Emanuel Seller in 1922.
Ooh. And he held the seat for about 150 years.
He held it for 50 years, and he gave it to his brother, Wine.
So
do you know Wine
later,
Seller?
Later, this was held by Anthony Weiner, not
yes.
Weiner.
No, I don't want to know what was held by Anthony Weiner. It was followed by Elizabeth Holzman. It was Emanuel Seller, then Elizabeth Holzman, then Charles Schumer, and
yes.
then
yes.
Anthony Weiner.
All Democratic institutions.
As they should be.
Then they nominated David Weprin.
Well, they didn't nominate him. They chose him.
Part of the problem.
Exactly. They anointed him because when Anthony Weiner resigned in June because of the twittering sex scandal, the Queens Democratic leader, Joe Crowley, who was a member of Congress.
Himself.
That's right. Decided to pick David Weprin, son of an assembly speaker.
And Saul Weprin.
Saul Weprin, right. He's an assemblyman, and they figure, look, this has been held since 1923. This should be a slam dunk.
It's automatic.
Well, no, of course, the district is not the way it used to be. In the old days, it was the Flatbush section of Brooklyn, mostly Jewish and some Italian, Irish, but mostly a Jewish district. But then in the last 10 years or so, it has extended out to Queens, where it's now two-thirds of the district is now in Queens.
Big difference. So the district was becoming more problematic for any nominee of the Democratic Party, and just problematic in general for any particular candidate, but especially in these times because of the economy, because of President Obama's positions on Israel, which were bothering an awful lot of
Orthodox Jews,
and other Jews.
Although David Weprin is an Orthodox Jew.
That is correct.
A Democratic candidate.
And his opponent is not, but
Roman Catholic Bob Turner.
That's right. But one of the other assemblymen from the district, a Democratic assemblyman who is another Orthodox Jew and a strong supporter of Israel, came out for the Republican candidate.
Did Ed Koch, the former mayor, Democratic mayor.
There you go. And then also, I think there were some other issues having to do with the Democratic candidate himself, who misstated the size of the federal deficit.
Well, he was close.
By $10 trillion.
He thought it was $4 trillion, but it was a $14 trillion.
Well, so he just left out a one.
A one.
Okay. He made a fair number of other mistakes. And Bob Turner, while
as an Orthodox Jew, he also voted for same-sex marriage.
That's the other one I wanted to get
too.
To. Because an awful lot of people really objected to that vote. It was a highly controversial action in the New York State Legislature, and he was on the wrong side of that issue, particularly from the standpoint of his assembly colleagues who were Orthodox Jews.
Right. I mean, between Orthodox Jews and conservative Catholics who were in that district, I mean, that was a bad vote, plus the fact that Barack Obama only got 55% of the vote in that district, his second lowest other than Staten Island, the second lowest in a congressional district in New York City. So,
and his approval rating in that district is very low.
It's really
quite stunningly low for a Democratic president, not only on the Israel issue, but just on the general lack of success in the recovery of the economy and a great number of other issues.
So Bob Turner wins 54-46, and we keep saying, it doesn't really matter because this district will be eliminated.
Maybe not now.
It may not be.
Not now, because it's now a Republican district, and the Republicans will go to bat for it.
Right, because the plan is if New York loses two, there would be one Democratic and one Republican district, and we always thought this would be a Democratic district they'd just get rid of. But if Bob Turner is eliminated, one, he could run against Gary Ackerman or somebody, or Joe Crowley.
Cause real problems for another incumbent.
Right.
So they may just decide to accept Bob Turner and eliminate a Republican district somewhere else in the state, maybe out west, where a Republican would be more likely to be able to win re-election easily, and where eliminating that district would actually solve problems for Democrats.
But what's the message here? I mean, does it mean, first of all, I don't know what it means for 2012, and the reason I say that is because we always go back to New York 22, back in 2009, when the famous Didi Scozafava, take a drink, district, where when the Republicans lost it after holding it for decades, Democrats won, and they said, well, this really foretells 2010.
Of course it didn't.
Of course not.
Not even in the state of New York.
Exactly right.
And so we can never draw too many conclusions from this, but I think it is also fair to say that this district result, and of course the crushing of the Democratic candidate out in Nevada on the same day, who never probably had a chance in a district.
But not by 22 points.
This was a district that's never been Democratic. It's always been the most Republican part of Nevada, and that was not a surprise, although the margin was obviously very discouraging.
Let me just say one thing about Nevada, but the Democratic candidate was the state treasurer who had won overwhelmingly in the district last year when she was reelected. But, right.
Yeah, a completely different set of dynamics. But I think it's fair to say that New York 9 plus the Nevada district taken together are an indication of the unease, the disquietude, the outright anger toward Washington, D.C., and toward the Obama administration and toward the Democratic Party felt in widely disparate parts of the country at this particular point in time.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, Nevada, again, is not as shocking. But, again, in New York City, it's one thing for a Democratic candidate to run away from President Obama in North Carolina or Idaho, where Walt Minnick basically ran. It was a very conservative Democrat, but he still wasn't good enough for the folks in Idaho.
He still had a D.
But in New York, exactly, the D is what it was. And now in New York, but New York's 9th congressional district, I mean, that's just remarkable.
It truly is. And I think we'll be hearing this used as a touchstone for quite some time. However, at the same breath, you have to stop and say, before we go too much further in deciding whether this is a one-term presidency and whether or not Obama can recover from this, that the larger issues facing his presidency, the state of the economy, state of world affairs, and the state of the Republican Party are all still very much in flux. And we could see a good deal of change in the energy of the body politic over the next year. But all of these signs up to now are not hopeful 14 months out.
We seem to be seeing some kind of change in the dynamic on the Republican side. If you go by the polls of this week, of course, polls are transitory and things can change, and they do change. Just a few months ago, it was Michelle Bachmann was the flavor of the month, and we couldn't stop talking about that. But look at what happened. I mean, not too long ago, Rick Perry was the clear front, I mean, here we go again, the front runner on the Republican side.
Well, and, last week.
Right, well, that's a long time ago, since he got in the race and made a splash. But the last two debates have not been good for Rick Perry. He's been on the defensive a lot.
I raise about $30 million. And if you're saying that I can be bought for $5,000, I'm offended.
Let's just back this up and talk a little bit about the trajectory of the Perry candidacy. For a long time, it wasn't clear he was going to run. Then, and a lot of us doubted it. Then it became
a lot of us. You mean a lot of me and you?
Like you and I doubted it, and a lot of other people did as well. I was putting his name on the list just because he's the governor of Texas, and having that asset alone made him worthy of putting on the list. But we didn't really think that he himself personally had the drive, personally had the fire to be president, or to take on everything he knew was going to come his way. So here he is now. He gets in the race. He is, you know, he owns the month of August. He owns pretty much the first hour of the first debate that he was in. He looked fabulous. He seemed to really be on a roll. And then he started hitting some potholes in the road, some rough spots. And then in the second debate, he was really made the target of all the other candidates and did not handle it as well as Romney did when he was the front runner.
And the way he handled it was similar to the way Romney took the criticism in 2008. He didn't handle it well either when he was going after Huckabee and McCain and Giuliani, saying they're not sufficiently conservative, and yet Romney's whole record is fraught with flip-flops, if you will, or certainly changes of position. So, but Romney seemed to have learned something from 2008. We keep saying that usually the Republican Party nominates somebody who's gone through the process once before and failed and came back. We saw that with McCain. We saw that with Bush. We saw that with Reagan.
People who had been in line.
Right, right. And you wonder if Rick Perry was completely prepared for it, because these were the obvious questions. Given what we saw in debate number one with Perry, you knew that the question would be about the vaccine in Texas and the Ponzi scheme and things like that. And yet he still seemed like on the defensive and unsure of his answers.
You know, I was reminded in the second debate, this is the one that was in Tampa this week, of the performance of Hillary Clinton when she was the clear front runner 4 years ago for the Democratic nomination. She was on absolute cruise control. All the polls showed her well over 40% the choice of a Democratic
Party. In a huge field.
In a huge field. Yeah. With other people who had well-known names and resumes, and then with this new guy, Barack Obama. And yet she was totally in control until one debate.
I remember that.
One question. It was about driver's licenses in the state of New York.
It was Philadelphia, and it was Tim Russert.
Do you support his plan?
You know, Tim, this is where everybody plays gotcha. It makes a lot of sense. What is the governor supposed to do?
I think of that all the time. I keep thinking that I don't know how Hillary Clinton is derailed from the nomination. Smooth sailing. Don't lay a glove on her. She also, similar to Mitt Romney earlier this year, she seemed to focus her ire on Bush and the Republicans and not the rest of the Democrats.
Couldn't care less about
when
those
When she
other guys.
Couldn't answer the question about driver's license for illegal immigrants, that was the first time I felt that we have a race for the Democratic nomination.
It was partly because she had been so perfect
as
a campaign up to then, and her campaign had seemed so seamless. I would say that after that, her vulnerability was immediately exploited by the media.
Right.
And she was perhaps unfairly characterized as stumbling, and the other candidates really got back in the game. I'm not sure we're at exactly that point here with Perry, partly because his front runner status is really so newly minted, just a month old. But he does need to figure out a way to deal with this pack of people who are jumping all over him. And he also, I think, needs to find a little bit better sense of how to appeal beyond the Republican base. He is showing no interest, at this juncture at least, in independent voters or in more lightly identified Republicans. Everything is going straight at the hardcore.
Oh, I don't think that Rick Perry has any desire at all to change that strategy at all. I think he feels, and with perhaps some justification, that he needs to just worry about the Republican base and not worry about November. This is a question that the Republican Party electorate and the establishment and the voters will have to answer. It reminds me of 1964. Was Barry Goldwater the strongest candidate against Lyndon Johnson?
No.
Probably not, but was he the ideologically pure candidate, the true Republican positions? Yes.
And he was clearly the favorite of the Republican base.
Right, exactly. And so you wonder whether, like, is Rick Perry just, you know, when every time he opens his mouth on Social Security, does the Republican establishment just, you know, grab their chest and start to
some
panic?
Some do, yes.
I'm sure some do, but there's some say, look, first of all, who knows what the electorate is like anymore? I mean, I don't know what the establishment means anymore, and I don't know what moderation means anymore. If the voters out there are this angry and this disturbed about what's going on in Washington, then maybe they could embrace, I mean, I don't know if I feel that in my heart, but maybe they could embrace just, you know, red meat rhetoric and all the way to November of 2012.
I think there's a presumption on the part of many conservatives that Barack Obama is coming apart, that he was a kind of brief phenomenon, a skyrocket, who has run his course and will not be effective as a politician in 2012, that things are going to be so bad with the economy and other elements of the world that the voters are going to want somebody else. And whomever they nominate, no matter what, whether it's a Barry Goldwater, whether it's a Ronald Reagan, like the 1980 situation, the Republican nominee is going to be the winner almost by default. And therefore, they want to get a guy they truly believe in, absolutely, not a Mitt Romney, whom they see as a trimmer. They see him as somebody who may be with him and may not. They want to get their guy, and they think Rick Perry is their best
shot. I think that was what Bobby Jindal was thinking this week when he endorsed Rick Perry. I think he said he is going to be our strongest candidate that we could unite behind to beat President Obama. I think you and I both agree, though, that the Republican nomination is far more valuable now than it may have been a month or so ago. In other words,
6 months ago.
Well, certainly 6 months ago. But it seems like I always thought that, well, you know, as bad as the unemployment is, you know, the 9.1 unemployment and probably 16% if you include the people who have given up looking for jobs. There are 14 million unemployed folks. I kept thinking that if the American public feels that the Republican nominee is just too extreme, that, you know, it's just like Harry Reid. His job, he's not doing a good job, but compared to the Republicans, he goes down. But I now think that the Republicans may have something going on here. And then the Democrats should be, at least in September 2011, should be rightfully worried about 2012, because with Obama's numbers in the low 40s and unemployment being the way it is, you don't usually reelect a president with those numbers.
No, in fact, no one's ever been reelected with unemployment that high or with consumer confidence this low.
Except FDR.
Except FDR, who was seen as being clearly an agent of change in the direction of creating more employment and, of course, had taken over the office with unemployment at a skyrocketing figure without any precedent or a figure that we had never seen before and haven't seen since. So he got a special pass, obviously, in 1936. Barack Obama's not getting anything like that. Number of developments in the states this week that we want to talk about. First of all, Ohio redistricting, kind of a surprise. They didn't draw Dennis Kucinich out of existence.
Well, Dennis Kucinich, for the longest time, was thought to be looking at this new congressional district in Washington State around Olympia, and he'd been giving speeches there and everything like that, but the Republicans didn't do him a great favor. where they did keep his district pretty much intact, but he will be merged with a fellow Democrat, Marcy Kaptur.
A very different kind of Democrat.
Different kind of Democrat, but, I mean, this could be very ugly. It reminds me of, do you remember Lynn Rivers versus John Dingell in Michigan?
Yes, in Michigan. And, of course, Lynn Rivers was supposed to be the next generation. Right. Dingell was supposed to retire. He said, no, I'm not going to retire. Right, so and he ran for
this
his
could be
seat.
Very ugly. And, you know, just as the Illinois Democrats are doing everything they can to obliterate the Republicans in Illinois, six or seven Republicans may go down to defeat. You see this in states where the Republicans control the mechanism, the political mechanism. In states like Ohio, they certainly will make things very difficult for either or both Kaptur and Kucinich.
And an interesting development that's somewhat related and somewhat similar to this redistricting game, the legislature in Pennsylvania, with a Republican governor backing them up,
and a Republican legislature,
is considering a plan to divide its electoral college vote in the year 2012. Now, Maine already does this. If the two CDs, the two congressional districts of Maine, go for different presidential candidates, the state splits its electoral college vote. The winner statewide gets the Senate votes, too, right. And then the two other votes can be divided between the two
winners. Congressional district.
That's right. And Nebraska also has this, and we were reminded of that in 2008.
First time in history.
When, for the first time in history, the district around Omaha voted for Barack Obama. Therefore, he got one lonely electoral college vote out of the state of Nebraska, which overwhelmingly went statewide for John McCain.
As it always does for Republicans. Now, Maine and Nebraska are the only states that have that. Now, of course, if only Pennsylvania does that, that could be very bad news for President Obama because, I mean, not that it's an overwhelmingly Democratic state, but I believe it's gone Democratic every year since 88. And so it just seems like this would be very good news for a Republican candidate.
Well, it means they're going to pick up 8 or 9 or 10 electoral votes instead of getting zero if the state statewide goes for Obama.
See, I think, though, this is the way we should reform. If we're going to reform the Electoral College, this should be the way to do it. And the reason I say that, if I'm a Democrat in Texas or I'm a Republican in New York, I basically have no say in the presidential race. There's no way that New York is going to go Republican. There's no way that Texas is going to go Democratic, at least in the current demographics.
Yes, but that would be only if all 50 states.
That's the point. If it's just Pennsylvania or it's just Democratic-leaning states.
And there was an attempt to do this in California a while back.
Right.
It failed. But if you did it in California, that would be the gift of 20 or 22 or 23 electoral college votes for the Republicans that they couldn't win any other way. Of course, the other way to reform the Electoral College would be to just allow a popular vote to elect the president the way it's done in most countries.
Well, that makes sense because if we had a popular vote presidential election, the presidential candidates wouldn't be spending all their time in the so-called purple states. I mean, there's nothing wrong with campaigning in Virginia, North Carolina, Florida, Ohio, but New Mexico and...
But theoretically, in a popular vote election,
you
go anywhere.
You campaign in New York.
Anywhere.
You campaign in California. You campaign in Texas. Right?
Campaign any place that is easy to get to. You may not go to Hawaii and Alaska, but you go any place where people live, and that would eliminate this enormous focus on just a tiny handful of states, which at this point everyone expects to determine the presidential outcome.
I mean, you didn't see Abraham Lincoln campaigning in Alaska and Hawaii.
And he didn't spend much time in California
no,
either.
No, no.
Okay, also out in the states, Elizabeth Warren made it official in Massachusetts.
I still think, first of all, I mean, Scott Brown still remains the most popular public official in Massachusetts.
Not necessarily saying a great deal to say you're the most popular politician in any state in this particular moment.
True, but to say that a Republican is popular in Massachusetts.
And I think Scott Brown is going to be very hard to beat.
He is. He has $10 million in the bank already, but Elizabeth Warren will get a lot of money from progressive and feminist groups around the country. She stands up to the bank. She stands up to the establishment. I mean, she would have been tough as the head of that consumer group, advocacy group, and if the Senate would ever allow to vote on it. But the Republicans are already seeing her trying to portray her as a Harvard elitist. It's going to be a tough battle, but I still think that if you look at the map, Scott Brown is still the most vulnerable Republican in the country.
If there is one, it's got to be Scott Brown just because Massachusetts is Massachusetts,
right.
And he hasn't been there that long, and the Tea Party people are a little disillusioned with him, and so he'll have vulnerabilities too. But probably Elizabeth Warren would have had a better chance of beating Scott Brown if she'd been nominated against him in the first place instead of Martha Coakley.
Well, the thing is, and it's interesting because what happened in New York 9 last week, the thought of a district that has gone Democratic for nearly 80 years has to remind me, a lot of people, of what happened in Massachusetts in 2010 when Ted Kennedy's seat 47 years held by Ted Kennedy goes to a Republican. So it's going to, obviously, it's a seat they desperately want back for symbolic reasons as well as ideological reasons.
A moment ago, you said 80 years. And actually, New York 9 has been in the Democrats' hands for 90 years.
You know something? The 60s, I don't remember.
You just lost a decade there.
Yeah,
was it the 60s or the 70s?
I don't remember that either.
I understand. And that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.